Welcome back to Issues Etc. Audio Open Lines continues for just about another 10 minutes. I want to be able to get this piece in on the South Dakota law that would be banning all abortions with the exception of the life of the mother. And it's up for a vote coming up 1 week from tomorrow in South Dakota. We'll play that in just a moment in Audio Open Lines. Then Pastors Rod Zwanitzer and Joel Baisley of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Dearborn, Michigan will join us to talk about the World Series. We've got to settle a bet. And then Rick Horton, former Cardinals, Dodgers, and White Sox pitcher and director of the Greater St. Louis Area Fellowship of Christian Athletes, will join us for his thoughts on the Cards win and the series in general. That's coming up here in just about 10 minutes on Issues Etc. Before that, listen to this. This comes from our Issues Etc. book of the month for October. It's called The Apostles' Creed. The good news for us, my dear friends, as you see, is that through Jesus' death, he's redeemed you and me. Although we are lost and condemned by our sin, by Christ's death on the cross, resurrection, we win. These are familiar words. You're trying to teach your kid the catechism. Listen to these. He buys us all back, as scriptures have told, but with his lifeblood, most precious, not silver or gold, since the wages of sin have been taken away, we can now be with him forever someday. Just a few lines from our Issues Etc. book of the month for October. It's a children's picture book called The Apostles' Creed. It teaches the doctrine of the Trinity in a Christ-centered and cross-focused way to your kids or your grandkids. It's $9.99 plus shipping and handling, and you can find it at our website, issuesetc.org. It's right there on the homepage. You can also call and order The Apostles' Creed. Great Christmas gift, by the way. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for October, The Apostles' Creed. We have to get this in. South Dakota has been a battleground state. I think there is one abortion clinic left in South Dakota. And if you've been following the news in that state, they've been working hard to try and ban abortion, elective abortion, entirely. South Dakota has the most restrictive abortion law on its ballot coming up a week from tomorrow. Here's the story from CNN.
If lawn signs were votes,
or you can visit us at voteyesforlife.com.
If the size of the war room were a measure, if a full-on blitz said something about turnout.
We're doing door-to-door. We've got radio ads, TV ads. We have postcard parties. We have home parties where there's a DVD.
If all that counted, then South Dakota might be on its way to banning abortion except when the mother's life is threatened, the most restrictive abortion law in the nation. But lawn signs, war rooms, and ads aren't votes. What you hear might not be what you get.
I believe that our folks are working very hard. They're just not as noisy as the other side.
Opponents of the abortion ban count on the unspoken.
The silent majority. And I do feel that there are, throughout the state of South Dakota, there are many people like that. And I do think they are going to come to the polls in the general election.
Clarence Koistra is against abortion, but thinks the ban is unconstitutional. He voted against it when it came up in the state legislature, which is why he's now an ex-state senator and an ex-Republican. But this debate does not fit the usual template. South Dakota is a conservative anti-abortion state. No doctor here will perform an abortion, though the one featured in this ad used to.
I think this is the time to ban abortion on demand in our state. I don't think it's necessary.
There is one clinic in Sioux Falls. It is manned by out-of-state doctors who drive or fly in to perform abortions. Casey Merschel heads a group fighting the abortion ban. She is pro-abortion rights and a Republican. But she says the state is less Republican or Democrat than it is libertarian.
There really is a resistance to too much government, a real respect for people making their own decisions and for self-determination.
She believes in that silent majority.
It's my hope that they will quietly go to the polls and vote no.
South Dakota seems an unlikely place to have a rumble, but it's got one, and it could start one.
If this bill wins in this state, I think the same thing. There's going to be a very positive reaction across all of the other 49 states.
Or it could fail. It's hard to figure.
Well, it is always hard to figure before the vote itself, isn't it? But it sounds like wishful thinking. The big question is, if the bill that would ban all abortions in South Dakota were actually to make it through this referendum a week from tomorrow, and they have an abortion ban, the only ban on abortion in the 50 United States. What becomes of it next? It's one thing for the people of South Dakota to say, yeah, we want all abortions banned with the single exception of the life of the mother. It's another thing to pass constitutional muster, which has yet to be seen. And that, of course, is also another unknown.
For the first time since 1982, St. Louis has a World Series winner. Here's the final out. And it's Wainwright who gets mobbed in the middle of the diamond. Jason Isringhausen, the closer, for the first 4 months of the season, asked Adam Wainwright, have you ever been swarmed? Well, he's swarmed tonight in a big, big way.
It's the final play and the final out of the World Series called by Joe Buck. Boy, I tell you what, that was exciting. I was listening to it on the radio, driving down the road with my daughter. A very exciting win. I had to go pick her up, but I kept the radio on because it came down literally to the last pitch and the last strike. And the Cards were victorious, which harkens back to a previous conversation here on Issues Etc. The last time Pastors Rod Zwanicher and Joel Baisley were with us, just last week, the outcome of the World Series was entirely unknown. Now that we know it, well, Pastor Zwanicher's wine cellar is going to be one bottle lighter and mine one bottle heavier in time. Pastors Rod Zwanicher and Joel Baisley join us to talk about the World Series. They're pastors of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Dearborn, Michigan, and hopefully to make good on their bet. Gentlemen, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Hi, Todd.
Rod, have you had any parishioners coming in seeking pastoral counseling after the Tigers lost?
Lots of severe depression going on around here, Todd.
Really, what's been the reaction of the people there in Dearborn?
I think they were just sad that the Tigers didn't play as well as they could. Not so much that they lost, but they just didn't play well at all. So, I think we're thrilled that they got this far.
Joel, anyone coming to you for a little consolation?
No, everyone sort of exhaled. It's such an exciting thing to get to the World Series, and everyone was obviously excited about it, but now that the outcome is assured, everyone is sort of relieved that it's over, and again, as Rod said, there's a mixed reaction. Disappointment with the way they played their last games, but really thrilled that they exceeded expectations this year by far.
Joel, when did you know it was over? When did you know that, all right, this is it, we're done, it was good to visit St. Louis, it was good to be in the series, but we're headed back to Detroit without the trophy?
It was really in the last game when we got another of those infamous pitching errors that I just wanted to turn off the TV and said, well, that's it, I think.
Rod, what about you? When did you realize it was pretty much a foregone conclusion?
Well, I was listening to Joel's answer, and I think that was it. When Verlander, threw it past the third baseman, I went, how many more times can we do? I just didn't think we would come back. So, yeah.
And yet, it came down to the last pitch and really the last strike, because with two men on base and one of their big hitters at bat, Inge is no small potatoes. Had he hit that and driven those runs in, the games would have gone on.
I think that sign in the stand said it all. Hit it to the pitcher. That was the series. That was the strategy. Just hit it to our pitchers. So.
And Joel, going into this, it was the Detroit pitching that was going to be the engine that would drive them. Many people were predicting a World Series sweep.
Yes, I said before the series that if their dominant pitching continued, and they pitch with the kind of confidence and control that they had in the previous two series, I still think they would have won. But considering the youth of the pitching staff, maybe the outcome was not that surprising.
It looked to me that they were pitching well. I mean, the Detroit pitchers weren't pitching poorly. I mean, there were some dark spots, but no more dark spots than the Cardinals had in their lineup. It was when they were asked to field
Right, and I thought the technical, I think one of the Cardinals on the bench was wired and said it. He noticed it before Joe Buck or any of the commentators did, that when it came to them, they were flat-footed, which meant they weren't prepared to do that fielding. And again, I think that may have been a sign of their immaturity.
So what kind of a reception did the Tigers get when they returned to the Motor City?
I don't know. I didn't go out.
Did you by any chance catch, I don't know if they were playing this nationally, but there was a, what did they say, Jeff, 500,000 people downtown yesterday? Or day, was it yesterday, day before yesterday? Yesterday. 500,000 people downtown, largest parade ever in St. Louis history on record for the Cardinals, ending up in a big gala that they had down there at the new Busch Stadium. Did you catch any of it, guys?
I saw it on ESPN, I think, today or last night. It looked like a fantastic event for the city.
No, it certainly was, I think, without a doubt. So what's the general reaction there among Tigers fans to the buildup and then the pretty quick letdown? How would you characterize it, Rod?
I think just so many of us just don't want to think about it anymore. You know, you get all built up and you get hyped up for it, and then, you know, it's over and it's kind of on to new things, you know, rake the leaves and, you know, carve a few pumpkins and just kind of forget about it. We're hoping that's what you guys did, but when your producer sent me the email you wanted to talk about, I said, uh-oh, they didn't forget.
No. In fact, now let's talk adult beverages for just a moment before I let you gentlemen go. I think it's Wild Horse. What was it that you served at your house that night with lamb chops and baby mozzarella with tomatoes and basil? What was it that you served the Wild Horse?
A Pinot Noir.
It was a Pinot
Wild
Noir.
Horse, right, yeah. Listen, I've got a proposition. How about double or nothing on the hockey season between the Blues and the Red Wings?
No way. Absolutely no way.
No way. Okay. We're only up 1-0. I mean, come on.
They call that a sucker's bet. And I'm not really even a betting man in the first place. So now, have you worked out the legalities here, Rod? Can you ship a bottle of wine from?
I checked all that out, and I think we're good to go there. So. Now you didn't say anything. Did you want that bottle full of wine or just a bottle?
I want a bottle of wine, not a wine bottle, please.
Oh, gee, I thought it was just a wine. I'm going to have to go back and play that tape. Can Jeff?
Yeah, an unopened, please.
Okay.
I will have to say, before I let you guys go, during the entire World Series, the commercial that ran the most was for Budweiser Select, and you guys had asked for a case of Budweiser Select if, in fact, you were to win. And every time I saw the commercial, of course, the logo was every place, too, during the World Series coverage, I felt a twinge of, fear, guilt, something along those lines that I might have to actually go out and make good on mine. But I'm enjoying one of my favorite emotions, which is relief at this particular point. And looking forward to a little bit of that Wild Horse.
Are you going to share that with Jeff, or is this just all?
I'm going to share it with my wife.
Oh, okay.
Jeff didn't make the bet.
Okay.
And so Jeff benefits in no way whatsoever.
Okay.
Yeah. If you want to make a bet with Jeff on sports, do that at your own risk.
Okay.
But he only bets on Missouri Tigers, not Detroit Tigers. I mean, Mizzou, if you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being our guests, and thanks for being good sports.
Thanks for having us.
Pastors Rod Zwanertz and Pastor Joel Baisley, pastors at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Dearborn, Michigan. Well, in a few minutes here, Rick Horton, a former Cardinals, Dodgers, and White Sox pitcher, is going to join us for his thoughts on the World Series win last week. Until then, LCMS World Relief, on a more serious note, of course, LCMS World Relief is concerned about the big issues, those that affect people far away and often out of our sight. You could turn on television and watch sports or anything you want to anytime. But very often, the kind of human suffering that LCMS World Relief deals with on a regular daily basis across the world does not come to us. It's not so visible to us. That's why they are there asking for your support. For more information about LCMS World Relief and their many efforts worldwide with Christ-centered, cross-focused care, you can call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, or you can find them, LCMS World Relief, at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Rick Horton will join us here in just a moment. And then at 4:30, Keith Thompson is author of the book, Leaving the Left, moments in the news that made me ashamed to be a liberal. He's going to talk about the left and moral relativism. He's a former staffer for Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum and an independent journalist. He'll join us at 4:30, running into the second hour. Then, shortly after the second hour begins, Pastor Brent Kuhlman will be our guest. We'll be talking with him about forensic justification. That is, justification, as Paul describes it, God's declaration of the sinner righteous before God for Christ's sake alone, by God's grace, to be received through faith. We'll be talking about that in the last 50 minutes of Issues Etc. today. While we're waiting for Rick Horton, let's hear a little bit more of our audio and continue with some audio open lines. Big question, of course, going into the November elections is the values voter, and the big question surrounding the values voter, are those family values changing, and will they make a difference for future elections? Here's the story.
Bethel University attracts some of the most conservative evangelical students in the country.
You know, I was raised going to pro-life rallies. I do believe in family values.
All students here sign a covenant.
We will abstain from use or possession of alcoholic beverages. We believe that sexual intercourse and other forms of intensely interpersonal sexual activity are reserved for monogamous heterosexual marriage. This is a tough moral standard.
We stand by these because we're community.
These kids were brought up on a diet of what evangelicals call family values, the staples of which are opposition to abortion and same-sex marriage. And yet here, on this deeply religious campus, these four students, two Republicans, a Democrat, and an undecided, say that while those family values are important to them, they're not the only values they'll vote on.
The state of humanity globally, and that could encompass things like, you know, AIDS and poverty and things like that, is tremendously important right now to students. I'd say domestic poverty. And then family values on top of that. Abortion's always going to be there. It's always going to be in our minds. But right now, things like the war in Iraq are going on. And so we're really concerned, you know, we're concerned about that.
The students aren't alone in shifting away from the predominant emphasis on family values that has shaped the evangelical political voice in the last 30 years. Tonight, they are among 2,000 at this evangelical stronghold applauding Reverend Jim Wallace, one of the most liberal evangelical leaders.
We support our values, but all our values. And I'm on record as saying those who say there are only two moral values are mistaken.
When I find 2,000 verses in my Bible about poor people, I insist fighting poverty is a moral values issue too. So is protecting the environment. Here they call it creation care.
Some conservative evangelical leaders are coming aboard too. Richard Cizik of the National Association of Evangelicals is even featured in a new movie on global warming, once considered a liberal issue.
To deplete our resources, to harm this world by environmental degradation, is an offense against God.
And Cizik just signed an open letter to President Bush urging him to do more to stop the genocide in Darfur. It's a letter also signed by conservative leader Dr. Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention. Land says he's long been concerned about Darfur, the environment, and poverty. But he says the fight against same-sex marriage and abortion should and will remain the top issue among value voters.
I care about poor people, but a poor child, if he gets born or if she gets born, at least has some hope of escaping poverty. If he's killed before he's born, he doesn't have a chance to escape anything because he's dead.
But will those values remain the priority for evangelicals just entering the political process?
There's a shift that's happening. I mean, I've seen it since I came here.
They're not embracing all of Jim Wallace's beliefs on the left, but they're not entirely aligned with the right either. So candidates on both sides hoping to win evangelical votes in the future may have to reconsider their values. Delia Gallagher, CNN, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Well, it's hard to deny at this point that the values that are the values voters earmark are broadening. To say that it's changing... Well, it's changing in a sense. It's changing from a few things to a number of things. And I don't think there's any doubt that the younger generation, look at me, I sound like I'm 100 years old, but I don't think there's any doubt that the younger generation of evangelical voters are probably more concerned about more things politically than their parents or their grandparents were. But that's to be expected. I mean, politics is never written in stone. Political issues and even those that are not entirely political, but also of grave concern for Christians who allow their politics to be shaped and by the clear word of God, the word of God doesn't change, but the issues will change. And suddenly, someone will, I mean, for all my disagreement with Jim Wallis of Sojourners, he will remind us that stewardship of the planet is very important, that helping the poor is very important. That's all very good. But I think what Richard Land had to say at the end of that piece from CNN really is probably the best response to that. Look, it's not an either-or between gay marriage, abortion, and the environment, global warming, and all those things. It is a both and you really have to have that right to life before you can have liberty and the pursuit of happiness. That's a good way to end it. Rick Horton joins us. He's a former Cardinals, Dodgers, and White Sox pitcher, and he's director of the Greater St. Louis Area Fellowship of Christian Athletes. He joined us before the World Series to talk about it. Now he joins us for a little bit of post-series analysis. Rick, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, great to be back with you. Now, I'm trying to remember. I think I said the Cardinals were going to win in five. Is that what I said the first time I was on?
What did he say, Jeff? Made no present. We do have it on tape. We do have it on tape.
You know, that's the way life is. It's all on tape. But I'm afraid I did not predict what would happen. And it really was such a great joy to be a part of that. And I was actually a part of the parade yesterday in downtown St. Louis. I don't know if there are 500,000 people there or not. I know there were a lot of people. And what a joyous event it was. And I think people who are a part of it will remember that for a very long time.
Let's go back 24 years when the Cards last won the World Championship. How does this series compare with the 82 World Series?
Well, I was actually in the minor leagues at the time in 82. I was in the series in 85 and 87 when we lost. So the comparison there would be we lost and this time they won. But winning's more fun, of course. You know, there are a lot of other great things that happened, relationships that I formed in the series in 85 and 87, friendships that'll last a lifetime. And I do have great memories from those series. But 82, I think you had a team that was probably predicted to be a little bit better than this team in 2006. This team was just barely over 500 by the time the year ended, and people started to wonder whether or not they could get through the first round or not. And so it's really kind of interesting that they gelled at the right time. I'd say that's a similarity between 82 and this year, is that the teams gelled at the right time. And I think that's always true when it comes to baseball. I maintain that the Washington Nationals could win the World Series if they got somehow fortunate enough to be thrown there and just got at the right time.
All right, we're going to go to a break. Will you stick with us on the other side of the break, Rick?
I would be happy to.
All right, thank you. When we come back, we're going to hear from Rick Horton, as a former Cardinals, Dodgers, and White Sox pitcher and director of the Greater St. Louis Area Fellowship of Christian Athletes, as we talk about post-series analysis after the World Series. When we come back from this break, I'm going to want his thoughts on Tony La Russa's management of a team that, when it started this season, was, in a lot of ways, at least its makeup, a very different team than it when it ended this season, and also what he thinks the biggest surprise from this year's World Series is. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Rick Horton will be with us on the other side of the break for a few minutes, and then we'll be joined by Keith Thompson, talk about the left and moral relativism. He's author of the book Leaving the Left, Moments in the News That Made Me Ashamed to Be a Liberal. We'll talk about that after we conclude our conversation with Rick Horton after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Dale Meyer of the Meyer Minute here on AM 850 KFUO. As president of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, it's my privilege to live on our lovely campus. Every day I see the KFUO tower. It reminds me of our mission at the seminary and the mission of every Christian to get out the message of salvation in Jesus Christ. KFUO's founders erected their broadcast building here on the seminary campus in 1927, and the station's workers have been putting out the good news of the gospel ever since. I believe that the ministry of KFUO is worthy of your support, and I encourage you to consider becoming a member of the KFUO Founders Club. It's an annual investment of about $70 a month. Call Jeff Craigmeyer at 314-505-7867 and say, "I want to join the AM 850 KFUO Founders Club."
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Kim Troby, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. On the heels of the New Jersey Supreme Court deciding that gay marriage is a viable option in the Garden State, President Bush is reiterating his support for traditional marriage. Is it enough to reawaken a listless electorate to the importance of the coming election? Steve Jordahl reports.
Speaking at a campaign stop in Iowa, the president said the New Jersey ruling, quote, raises doubts about the institution of marriage and that it must be defended. Assistant to the president, Tim Gegline.
The president believes that marriage is a sacred institution between one man and one woman. And clearly, activist judges in Massachusetts and now in New Jersey feel that they should be legislating from the bench versus allowing the people to make that determination.
Gegline also said the president recognized the importance of this election in the battle for marriage. Gary Bauer of American Values says that's a fact many conservative voters may have forgotten.
There have been a number of good court decisions which took a little bit of steam out of the pro-family movement because there was a sense that the issue perhaps had been settled.
There are 20 states with amendments that protect marriage, all passed by large margins. But gay activists have been making strides. Bauer says the New Jersey ruling could help counter the propaganda.
I think it could potentially be a real catalyst here. It's a pretty stark reminder to, I think, millions of voters that there are some real important things at stake in this election as there is in every election.
Eight states have marriage amendments on the ballot next week. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Bauer is pleased the president spoke out in support of marriage, but noted that it seems to be a regular election season talking point for him. He's looking for more support of the federal marriage protection amendment next time it comes up in Congress. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
Hi, this is Pastor Mark Hawkinson inviting you to the CPH Warehouse Sale on Saturday, November the 4th. I have the privilege of awarding four $50 gift certificates, good toward warehouse sale purchases. Now, the drawing will be at 7:45 a.m., and you do need to be present to win. It's one registration per person, and you can call AM850-KFUO right now to register for the drawing. Call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, and I'll see you Saturday, November 4th at CPH.
It is true that the doctrine of the Trinity is something of a mystery, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't teach it to our young children. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for October is titled The Apostles' Creed. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The Apostles' Creed costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Apostles' Creed.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Rick Horton is our guest. We're talking about the World Series win last week. Rick is a former Cardinals, Dodgers, and White Sox pitcher, and he's director of the Greater St. Louis Area Fellowship of Christian Athletes. He's agreed to be with us for just a few more minutes here on the program. What was the most surprising moment or event or turn of events from this year's World Series for you, Rick?
Well, I think the big change was when the bullpen all of a sudden figured out how to be aggressive, confident, and capable all at the same time, all in like one day. I don't know whether it was Adam Wainwright who all of a sudden found that he was maybe had the mentality as well as the arm that fit as a short reliever, and then it just was a domino effect with everybody else. But one thing I noticed by watching the eyes of these guys who I'm, you know, very close with and have good relationships with a lot of those relievers, we tend to gravitate together for some reason, us old relievers, but we understand each other, let's put it that way. But these guys started to get it to the point where I could see it in their eyes. I could see their confidence growing, and all of a sudden, what was almost a weakness of a team became a strength down the stretch.
We talked to you, not last week, but when we talked to you, I think it was last year sometime here on the program about the Cards.
Yeah.
I had asked you a question about the contrast between Tony La Russa and Whitey Herzog's postseason management styles, and the comparison between the fact that I think you said that Whitey Herzog was as likely to talk about fishing or something like
Absolutely.
That on a game day. Very laid back. Tony La Russa is kind of known for his intense style, but I've noticed Tony's a little more subdued, especially in postseason play. How do you account for that more quiet approach?
That's very perceptive. I started to see that in Tony, even in the first round of the playoffs. I saw it We had a press conference where he actually told a little joke, and he said, "You know, I'm not really good with jokes, but I'm going to say it anyway." And he was more vulnerable maybe than before. And I don't know whether that's just an evolving style with his with him or not. I mean, he still likes pressure. Don't get me wrong, but I think he maybe this year, because of the way the team was going, had to exercise an enormous amount of patience, and maybe that led him to just kind of chill a little bit when it came to, you know, this pressure question. He had a couple of guys in his team that I would not have had as much patience with, and Marquis would be one, Weaver would be another. Guys, I mean, I don't know how they stayed patient with those guys, but they did, and even Supon had his moments where he was not pitching well, and a lot of folks who are following the Cardinals were saying, hey, get rid of Supon, and we can't let him start anymore. Well, all of a sudden he becomes a playoff hero, and somehow, you know, patience became a virtue for Tony this year. It's kind of like my good friend in FCA who said that he'd been praying diligently for patience for a couple of weeks and found himself stuck in an awful lot of traffic jams the next couple of weeks to maybe exercise and get a little practice. Well, I think Tony had a lot of practice in developing patience, and it may have led to that low-key approach.
Well, Whitey Herzog came to the Cards in 80, and in 2 years he had won a world championship. Tony La Russa has been with them 13, and this is the first. I mean, they've been to the playoffs a lot, but this is the first world championship. So is, you know, in Whitey Herzog's case, the monkey was kind of off his back, and he could lay back. Is the monkey off of Tony La Russa's back now?
I think the monkey is off his back in a lot of ways, yes. I think Tony has been trying to be accepted in St. Louis for a very long time, and people were having a hard time forgetting Whitey Herzog, who I love dearly and think is one of the greatest managers of people I've ever been around, in or outside of baseball. I just love the man. I think he's a wonderful baseball guy, and Tony had to follow that. And I think people in St. Louis see him as the West Coast guy, you know, not quite as the same kind of personality as Whitey. And I think he had a hard time being accepted. I think this will go a long way in taking that monkey off his back that he probably put on himself. I don't know that the fans put that on him as much as maybe he put that on himself. But I think going forward, I can tell you that if I know Tony La Russa, he's going to find some way to be motivated at another level when spring training comes around. He's going to enjoy it for a while, and he'll find a way to get hungry again.
All right, finally, give us the Cardinals' starting lineup for next year, their starting rotation, and then from the pitcher's perspective, who's going to be their closer next year?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say I can't answer the closer question. I think that, there's two answers that I could come up with. One would be Wainwright. Cardinals say, you know what, we got lightning in a bottle here. Why go back to that experiment we were talking about? He's a dynamite closer. Let's keep him there. Now, Wainwright may want to start, may not be his choice, but I'd like to see him in the rotation because I think he's got four quality pitches. A couple of them he doesn't even get a chance to use very much. So I'd like to see Wainwright and Reyes and Supon re-signed, and I would like to see Mulder as the fifth starter coming back with some kind of a deal. I mean, I think the Cardinals could get him for a good price. So I see him in the rotation. I think Josh Kinney could be a guy that could close. I thought phenomenal down the stretch, maybe give him and Tyler Johnson at least a chance to do that. But I think they'll probably be a few other guys out there on the free agent market that the Cardinals will go after.
Rick, the Greater St. Louis Area Fellowship of Christian Athletes is going to be hosting its annual dinner on Tuesday, November the 7th, 1 week from tomorrow. Tell us just a little bit about it.
Well, we have some tables open, and it's going to be a celebration of the ministry of FCA and our work with young athletes and coaches in St. Louis. Wayne Hagan will be up there, and we'll be honoring Wayne, actually, with the work that he's done in broadcasting here in St. Louis and celebrating a little bit what the Cardinals have done. But our work really, it transcends sports for the high school athlete. It goes beyond just baseball and football. And so we won't be too heavy on the baseball. But it's a chance, if you come to the FCA dinner, to see what we think God is doing through this work in the hearts and minds of young people to grow in their relationship with Jesus Christ. And we are really thrilled that Wayne's going to be there. Randy Mayfield will be there to provide music and humor as our MC. And we really hope people will come out, choose to contact us on our website, stlfca.org, to find out information about our annual dinner. It's really a chance for us to celebrate what God's allowing us to do in public and private schools in St. Louis.
Rick Horton is a former Cardinals, Dodgers, and White Sox pitcher. He's director of the Greater St. Louis Area Fellowship of Christian Athletes. They're going to have their annual dinner Tuesday, November the 7th. For more information, go to stlfca.org, stlfca.org, or you can call this number, area code 636-827-7100, 636-827-7100. Rick, thanks for being our guest.
Oh, you bet. Always great to visit with you guys.
Well, we've got another conversation lined up here. In fact, two more in our lineup for this Monday's Issues, et cetera. Keith Thompson joins us here to talk about the left and moral relativism. And then coming up in about 30 minutes, Pastor Brent Kuhlman will join us to talk about forensic justification. Keith Thomas is a former staffer for Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum. He's an independent journalist, and he's authored the new book, Leaving the Left, Moments in the News That Made Me Ashamed to Be a Liberal. Keith, welcome to Issues, et cetera.
Well, thanks very much. I heard that something happened out there pertaining to baseball.
Yeah, something you know, a little minor event that very few people took notice of.
But, well, we've got an active little league here, too, so I know how proud you folks must be.
We are very proud, in fact. Thanks for the congratulations. Keith, let's start with some more current news. It was just last week that the New Jersey Supreme Court decided to more or less mandate that the legislature in that state come up with something like gay marriage in law. What's your reaction to that?
Well, there are many ways we could talk about it. Substantively, of course, what's involved in that. But I've found myself most taken aback by the process. I mean, most of us, even if we slept through our high school civics classes, we unconsciously picked up the phrase, three separate and co-equal branches of government. We understood that was a pretty decisive part of what makes America unique. Each branch of government is a check and a balance on all the others. So, you know, I found myself amazed. Now, I have to admit, I did not read the ruling verbatim. I try to avoid reading judicial rulings because they're so badly written, and also they tend to carry such bad news these days. But I was struck by the court saying, you know, you've got to have gay marriage or something like gay marriage, and we command you, the legislature, to implement that in 180 days. I'm not a huge fan of Tony Soprano, but I know who he is and how he functions. And I thought, I'd like to see someone in the New Jersey legislature say, yeah, who you and who else are going to make us do this? So that I got to, that was my first and my gut response to the whole thing.
And now it sounds like that is one among many that have changed your thinking, not only politically, but also at an even more deeper philosophical level. Let's talk about the issue of choice and the issue of abortion. Where were you? Where are you now? And why the change?
Good, very good question. It's a decisive one for me. I, as a liberal, I was never a hardcore leftist, never a socialist, never a communist, but I was a liberal Democrat who had a kind of gut sense that, gut faith in a lot of the catechism, if you will, of the secular left. The secular left doesn't think it has a catechism because it doesn't think in religious terms, but a lot of its assumptions are religious, if you will, in terms of the structure. And there's no sacrament that's more important than the idea that a woman has the right to choose. Now, my sympathy with this early on was based on two things. One, I didn't read the Roe versus Wade decisions before I decided I was for it, so that was interesting. But I was in my 20s at the time. And secondly, I had an intuitive feeling that, yeah, a woman does should be able to control her own decision. When people would ask me, Keith, when do you think life begins? You know, my pro-life friends, I'd say, well, I don't know. I really don't know. It's up for, there are different ways to think about this, but each woman should have the right to make a choice. So, long story short, many years passed. I even was a pro-choice supporter. I marched in some demonstrations to that effect. There came a time several years ago, I'm a big fan of C-SPAN. I like to watch. I'm a political junkie, and I like a lot of the dialogue that happens there. There was a senatorial debate between Senator Rick Santorum, whom, as you know, is a strong pro-life defender, and Senator Frank Lautenberg, on a strong pro-choice advocate, on this hideous phenomenon of what I call, I now see as infanticide, called partial birth abortion. Senator Santorum turned to Senator Lautenberg and said, Senator, if the baby was delivered accidentally and the head slipped out, would you allow the doctor to kill the baby? To my surprise, Lautenberg says, I'm not making the decision, Senator. And then Senator Feingold, another pro-choice advocate, came to the Senate floor, and he wanted in on the action. So Santorum repeated the question, if the baby was delivered accidentally, Senator, and the head slipped out, would you allow the doctor to kill the baby? Feingold said, well, it's up to the doctor and the mother to decide. Well, I had already had disquiet in my heart and my mind and my soul about the subject of abortion, but that really did it for me. And I began to study, I began to answer the questions that I'd been refusing to see, and I came to the conclusion there's really no dispute in embryology that a fertilized embryo is not a potential human being with second class, right? It is an actual human being who's continuing to grow inside the mother. And for me, it finally settled the issue of this so-called libertarian property rights issue when I said, yes, a woman has the right to her own body, but there's another life inside her. And so her right to her body ends where her life ends, or her body ends, if you will. So my views have changed very much so, as did the Terry Schiavo case, changed my views on the whole right to die with dignity argument. There were several of these turning points for me.
I want to come back to the Terry Schiavo incident in just a moment, but do you think you were typical of the kind of policy wonk, political junkie who is pro-choice, that you had some pretty strong convictions based on relatively little knowledge or particulars?
Well, yes, and in fact, I have to give people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and some other pro-choice advocates at least some credit for the intellectual honesty in recent years of saying that Roe v. Wade is just an absolute nightmare of a decision from a judicial standpoint. It's on a crash course with it, a collision course with itself, because it allows viability, this question of viability, to be the idea that it's a stable point. But we know since Roe, the age at which prematurely born children survive in incubators, has lowered markedly. So beyond that fact, there's the fact that abortion was federalized through a judicial fiat. So, yes, I think a lot of people don't think through this issue. They fall back on, well, we don't know when human life begins. Or they'll say, well, life may begin, but we don't know when it becomes a person. This is Peter Singer of Princeton, the so-called ethics professor. We could have a whole conversation on him, as I'm sure you have in the past. His view that a 28-day-old severely deformed child, parents should have the right to kill a child up to 1 month if it's severely deformed because it is not yet a person. Oh, it's alive, but it's not yet a person. Well,
how did the Terry Schiavo incident, what happened there that changed your thoughts on the so-called right to die or death with dignity?
Well, you know, the phrase death with dignity has a surface appeal to it. You see it on a bumper sticker. You're not going to argue for death with no dignity. If you don't know anything other than the phrase, it makes sense. It feels intuitively right. That's the way propaganda, or at least rhetoric, works. So it's sort of like the phrase universal health care. It sounds great, but then you kind of scratch the surface. How does it get paid for? And it's not, or free health care. I like that. In any case, I paid attention to the Schiavo case because, as a reporter, I like to track details, and I followed it carefully. I know that Michael Schiavo, you know, her husband said, I won't turn her over to her parents, because he didn't want to do that. He said, I don't know what Terry wanted, but this is what we want. Well, who's the we? Bottom line is, I felt, the more I found out about that case, it was wrong to put Terry to death, and that's what was involved, absent clear and convincing evidence that this was her wish. Because while the Florida statute said that she had no right to live, the Florida Constitution trumps Florida statutes. And the Florida Constitution says all natural persons, female and male alike, are equal before the law and have inalienable rights, among which are the right to enjoy and defend life and liberty. Terry Schiavo had not sacrificed her natural rights because she'd committed no crime. So her natural right to life was abridged, and it's part of this whole lessening, especially since her mother, her father, her sisters wanted Terry to come home and be with them. So it's part of this whole lessening of the value of life, this coarsening of life, and we see that in Europe, in Holland, see a great deal of evidence that there's a growing pressure on old people to stop resisting. They should die. They should just give it up. They should come over. They're just inconvenient. And I find it very disturbing for liberals who once championed these things like Hubert Humphrey did when he said we got to care for the people at the beginning of life and the end of life and those who aren't cared for during life. That's the challenge of a civilized society.
Do you think that the left has lost its way in that it had in the past championed the helpless, the hopeless, the defenseless, and with maybe, I don't know, with maybe the Roe decision or something along those lines, while they still parrot those values, in actual practice, it is often the helpless, hopeless, the defenseless that get the wrong end of the stick every time.
You know, you're right, and I think there are a couple of things on a collision course here. And one is there's a thin line, and I say only seems to be, between the traditional liberal concern, and I want to talk about what liberalism is at its best, Franklin Roosevelt at its best, and even Lyndon Johnson and so forth. That is a concern for people in trouble. The great priests and religious figures of our time have stood with people in trouble. Abolition came about in America because of a solidarity with people in trouble. So that concern with people in trouble has morphed on the left into a concern for anyone who's not part of the mainstream, anyone who's outside the mainstream, who embraces any kind of alternative. And there is an animus, really an animosity toward mainstream American values, traditional values, received wisdom, everyday moral understandings that have guided centuries. I mean, I'm a conservative to this extent. If it has worked for human evolution, if you will, or for most human civilizations, whatever it is, we ought to look at that as having some survival value. But the left says, gee, if it's been working for this long, it must be oppressive. We've got to find out who it's oppressing. So the left has identified itself with every conceivable cause, and gay marriage is really only the most recent.
We're talking about the left and moral relativism. Keith Thompson, a former staffer for Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum, independent journalist and author of the new book, Leaving the Left, Moments in the News That Made Me Ashamed to Be a Liberal, is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live on this Monday, October the 30th. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio as well, issues@kfuo.org. So with regard to the Democratic Party, insofar as it's not completely coterminous with the left, but on the issue of the Democratic Party, how did it go from being the party of Hubert Humphrey, caring for life from beginning to end, to the party of moral relativism, generally speaking?
Well, I think there are several factors. One is I think there was a general shattering of America's consensus in the 1960s. We know now we weren't told the truth about Vietnam by the Johnson administration, and Richard Nixon certainly betrayed the trust of his supporters. I think the assassination of President Kennedy had something to do with turning the world upside down. But it didn't turn the world upside down for everyone, in this sense. I mean, conservatives and people who embrace traditional values didn't suddenly go crazy. So there's something about, something got in the water, if you will, for especially the academic left, which began to advocate that because we could study what other cultures believe at any given time, including now, there's really no way to judge that any culture is better or worse according to any criteria that are separate from any given observer. Sounds good on paper, that the idea that there are no universal truth claims that can be validated, but then you get into a problem. The idea that there's no universal truth claimed is itself a universal truth claim. You're making a universal claim that universal truth claims can't be trusted. So it undercuts the whole position, and it is. I think there's a deep narcissism, and in my book I try to describe, without getting too analytical, I think there's something about a certain dynamic in the baby boom generation, which is my own generation. This delaying of adolescence, extending of adolescence longer than any other generation, and ironically enacting a kind of rage against the very parents, the Depression-era parents who sacrificed so hard so that the baby boomers could be so successful and have so much privilege. I mean, it's something about the privilege that I think has led to almost a rage among many on the left. Maybe they didn't get enough spankings, to be very reductionistic about it.
We're talking with Keith Thompson, author of the book Leaving the Left. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's take a phone call here before this break. Steve calls from his car. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Just a very fascinating discussion. That's something I've studied, and particularly I agree with your comments on the baby boom generation. I'm right in the middle of that pack, and I just see a lot of my peers just seem to be sometimes, you know, way off the reservation in terms of not even be able to think rationally. And it kind of brings up my point. You seem to be able to speak and reason quite well. And I've noticed that when I've tried to debate or discuss some of these issues with my liberal friends, they really don't like to be faced by facts. They get very emotional and start calling names when they run up against that wall of facts that just don't agree with their viewpoint. And were you like that before? And if so, how did that, was it just those couple of shocking experiences you had with the Senate debate that you related that kind of woke you up? Or
Steve, thank you for the
like
thanks for the question.
Expound on that a little.
All right, we got about a minute here before we go to this break. Begin a response to Steve's question.
Let me just take a shot at that. I became a liberal because I grew up in a small town in Ohio that was frankly not conservative, but was actually very bigoted. It was a town where you could get in trouble for being black or being Catholic or being Jewish. So I made a decision. Gee, the liberals seem to be the ones who are for equal opportunity. I was very impressed by Dr. Martin Luther King at a very young age. But bottom line is, I was told by my mom and dad, think for myself, think for yourself. And with that in mind, I actually became a liberal. They were conservatives. But I took a political path that was different from theirs. But I have to say that as time goes on, I live in California now, the upbringing which I had, which I thought at the time was flat and narrow and maybe a little rigid, I am so glad I had that upbringing because it stands me in very good stead in Northern California. I think it's much better to be raised with your sense that the horizons are narrow, because that usually means you're getting some discipline and some values. And I thank my parents as time goes on because I think they did impart some basic, good old-fashioned Midwestern values.
We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll have a few more minutes with Keith Thompson, a former staffer for Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum, an independent journalist. He's authored this new book, Leaving the Left, Moments in the News That Made Me Ashamed to Be a Liberal. He's got a website address as well, leavingtheleft.com, leavingtheleft, all one word, .com. I want your phone calls and your emails after this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. When we come back, how does gay marriage threaten the future of the U.S., apart from the issue of judicial activism and judicial fiat? What's the danger there? We'll get that answer from Keith Thompson on the other side of this break. And then after about 10 more minutes, Pastor Brent Kuhlman will join us. We'll talk about forensic justification for the remainder of the program here on Issues Etc. Those call-in numbers again, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're coming to you live this Monday, the 30th of October, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we let Keith go, I'm going to want to know, is progress being made in the Democratic Party and on the left in general on social issues like abortion and homosexuality and euthanasia? Stay tuned. Our conversation with Keith continues after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.